We are lucky enough to live, work, and record this podcast on the land of the Kaurna people. We acknowledge their ongoing connection to sea country and the importance of Indigenous knowledge in caring for the ocean. Welcome to The Ocean Pod, a podcast about all things to do with marine science and the ocean. You are joined by myself, Dr. Nina Wooten, and my co-host, Professor Bronwyn Glanders. We are both marine scientists from the University of Adelaide with a huge passion for all things to do with the ocean. Hi, Bronwyn.
Hi, Nina. In this episode of Ocean Pod, we're thrilled to be joined by Professor Charlie Hooveniers, a world-renowned shark scientist who spent more than 20 years unlocking the secrets of great white sharks, among other species. From tracking their movements to understanding how they interact with humans, Charlie's work is helping shift the way we see and manage these powerful predators. He heads up the Southern Shark Ecology Group at Flinders University here in South Australia and plays a big role in shaping shark conservation policy both nationally and globally. In our chat, we explore what makes white sharks so fascinating, what it's really like to work with them, and how science is helping us move beyond fear to better understand their role in the ocean. But first, it's time for Tide Talk. Nina, what caught your attention this week?
So for my Tide Talk this week, I just wanted to provide a quick update on the ongoing harmful algae bloom that we have had impacting South Australia's coastline. We did have an episode on that with Sam Gaylard from the EPA a few episodes back. So if you want a whole update on what's going on more broadly, I would suggest that you go and listen to that episode. But of course, it's a bit of an evolving beast. And I think as South Australian marine scientists with a platform like we have with Ocean Pod, we need to make sure we're sharing the most up-to-date information that is happening to do with the algae bloom. As it's a great way to share it with all of our listeners and other people who are interested. So for those who don't want to go back and listen to the episode, pretty much there's this algae bloom that's happening in SA. Initially, it started off down on the Fleurieu Peninsula. And it's now grown to cover more than 500 kilometres of coastline, and it's affected somewhere towards 500 different species. And I think there's been reports of now nearly up towards 15,000 different species recorded on iNaturalist as washing up on our beaches. That, of course, is... We still don't know the impact of what's happening underwater. So that's just things that are washing up. There's probably that number is probably a lot higher if we consider everything that's going on underneath the water. We've just had some announcements recently that there's some funding to help support this algae bloom. So the federal parliament, the federal government announced that there was going to be $14 million to help with the bloom. And then the state South Australian government matched that to also put aside $14 million. I think this is going to help fast track some water testing and coordinate a scientific response and hopefully gather some data on what's actually happened, like the effects that's happened. I think hopefully also a lot of that's going to go to the fishing communities and different aquaculture and fishery industries, as well as tourism that's had to shut, or people's businesses like the seafood businesses have been impacted by the algae bloom being there. So I think there's some grants coming out from that as well. But yeah, I just wanted to give everyone an update. It's not the best time to be an SA marine scientist in terms of hope, but there are some things happening and we're all working in the background to hopefully get together and help combat this algae bloom that is really causing a lot of effects. What's your Tide Talk, Bronwyn?
Well, I've just returned from an international study tour with undergraduate students to Timor-Leste, which is an absolutely amazing country. It's a country in Southeast Asia. It's about an hour and 20-minute flight from Darwin, so you do get lots of people going there from Darwin. It pretty much comprises the eastern half of the island of Timor, and It's over the years. It was originally a Portuguese colony. It's actually got a bit of a sad history. It was a Portuguese colony until around 1975, and there's been a whole range of conflict there with the Indonesians invading and everything else. But on a more positive note, in 2002, it became the first new sovereign state of the 21st century. So it's its own country. Its own independent country now, and probably from a marine perspective, it's one of the most it's got some of the most biodiverse coral reefs in the world. And while I was diving, I was fortunate to see a dugong underwater.
How cool!
It was my absolute amazing dream. It was just a dive from Dili, so Dili Rock East, which has a dugong. It didn't hang around, it just kind of passed on through. But yeah, it was pretty amazing to see a dugong underwater.
Yeah, that's really cool. So how many students were there? 17?
We took 17 students that were mostly marine and wildlife conservation or ecology, evolutionary biology students. So they're second and third year students. And yeah, they had an absolutely fantastic time. They do a dive course, and then we look at some of the issues around conservation, around plastics in the marine environment, fish and invertebrate IDs, some seagrass monitoring, those sorts of things.
Oh, so awesome. Oh, I'm so jealous. Today we're diving into the world of one of the ocean's most iconic and often misunderstood predators, the great white shark. We're joined by Professor Charlie Hoeven-Heers, a global expert in shark ecology, conservation and management.
Charlie leads the Southern Shark Ecology Group at Flinders University here in South Australia and has spent over two decades studying shark behaviour, movement, sensory biology and human-shark interactions. He also works closely with government and policymakers to shape evidence-based shark conservation strategies both in Australia and internationally.
We'll be chatting about white sharks, of course, but also about what it's like to be a shark scientist, how science is influencing shark policy, and a few surprising things you might not know about these apex predators. Hi, Charlie. It's so great to have you with us today.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me today. I'm really looking forward to the chat.
Charlie, thank you so much for joining us. To kick things off, can you tell us a bit about how you first got into marine science and what led you to focus on sharks?
It all started really when I was 12 years old. It was the last year of my primary school when we were told to do a presentation on an animal. And most people were going to do it on horses or cats, dogs. And I think it was my mum who suggested, why don't you do it on sharks? And I went like, sure, why not? You know, let's see what we can come up with. And she bought me a book to do that presentation. And I read the book. And I still remember that I was surprised by how little we knew about sharks. Half the book was all about, we don't know this, we don't know that. And that really just got me interested in sharks. At first, I think I wanted to more be an underwater photographer of sharks, but that quickly evolved into that scientific query of understanding more about sharks. And we're now at a stage where we know much more about sharks than we used to, but there's still a lot that we don't know, and that still drives my interest in learning more about these sharks.
I love that. I love the link, like, to we didn't know a lot when you were younger, and then that leading into the science sort of things.
It's very cool.
There's also a really cool little story with that, is that first book that I got was under the scientific direction of a scientist who was an Australian scientist that was based in Tasmania in Hobart, John Stevens. And as part of my career, I got to interact with him and I got to do some field trip and to publish scientific publication with John Stevens, who's now a friend and a colleague as well. So it was a really,
really
nice
cool.
like book ending of going from, you know, reading from him and then working with him later on.
Oh, awesome. So you did like a marine science degree or?
Yeah, I did my, so I'm from Belgium originally, and I did my undergrad at the University of Southampton. Mm-hmm. And then I moved to Australia and did my PhD at Macquarie University in Sydney. And then I moved to South Australia about 16 years ago.
Okay. So your mum managed to find this book by John Stevens, an Australian, in Belgium?
Yeah, and it was translated in French as well. So that book got translated, and it was one of the books on sharks.
That's amazing. Awesome. So you already mentioned that we don't know a lot about white sharks, or when you first got into it, we didn't know so much. You've probably made, hopefully, big dents in changing some of that. But what is it about these animals that fascinate you the most?
Well, actually, it's not so much about white sharks. And I get this question all the time, because when you work on a charismatic megafauna, people typically ask you, you know, why you're so interested in them. And to me, it was always more the scientific question. And I'm kind of interested in any shark species.
Yeah.
And the main interest of sharks in general is because we knew little about it. I mean, we're talking back in the 90s, where people were still much more fearful of sharks, and there was lesser understanding, and perception have now changed a lot. But back then, we really didn't know much about it. So it was the lack of information, the scientific questions, the queries, the questions that really drove me into trying to learn more about them. But with the 500 plus different species of sharks, I'm really interested in any species and not specifically about white sharks.
Okay, do you have a favorite?
I probably should say Wobbegong sharks, because that's probably the species that I studied the most during my PhD. Okay. So I do have a bit of a soft spot for Wobbegongs.
Okay.
Awesome. So I know you're in the field a lot, and I imagine that no 2 days are the same. But what does a typical day in the life of Charlie look like, whether you're out on the water or you're working with data?
And I think that's what makes it really interesting in this career, is the diversity of work that we end up doing. And as you said, there's no typical days, really. One day I might be braving the South Australian winter to try to catch and tag a white shark. The next day I might be talking to governmental agencies about policies and how to better manage wildlife tourism, or how to try to protect humans in terms of shark bite mitigation measures. And the next day I'll be flying to French Polynesia to work with a research team, a French research team that use rebreathers to tag great hammerhead at 50 meters depth. Then I might come back to Australia and teach as part of my role at Flinders University in teaching marine biology and animal behavior. And then along all of that, I also support all PhD students working on a variety of projects. And then there's also the data analysis and writing up of all this knowledge that we're gaining. So it makes the work really interesting, certainly some long hours with it, but it does provide the ability to do a whole range of interesting work.
Yeah, you're a case study of a very diverse marine scientist, I would say. Just to go back on something, can you tell our listeners what a rebreather is?
Yeah, so there's different ways you can go, spend time underwater. All scuba divers will use what we call an open circuit system, where the air is in the tank, and when it gets expelled, it goes out through the regulator and basically comes out of the circuit. A rebreather is slightly different. It's called a closed circuit. So instead of the air coming out of the regulator, it stays within the system, and you basically have the more oxygen being put in that system and the carbon dioxide being removed of the system, going through what we call a scrubber, so that there's actually no bubbles coming out of the regulator. So whenever you see people with bubbles coming out, that's an open circuit. When there's no bubbles coming out, it's a closed circuit. And what that enables is to spend more time deeper.
Okay, so 50 metres you were saying today.
And I think the rebreathers are commonly used by the Navy and places like that, where they don't want people to be able to see you breathing.
Yeah, there's two main reasons to use them. Is that if you want to do some secretive operation, so Navy and the likes, so there's no bubbles coming to the surface, or if you want to spend more time longer at depth, because obviously the decompression requirements is different using a rebreather compared to an open circuit.
Okay. That makes sense. Sorry, that was a bit of a side journey, but sometimes I love scuba diving, so I always like to learn more. So the Southern Ocean and waters around South Australia are key habitats for a range of different shark species, including white sharks. What are some of the key findings from your research and how they are using this environment?
So what we're finding is that we're now learning, or we've learned a lot more about where these sharks are going, including where white sharks are going. And they're moving huge distances. The sharks that's been tagged in South Australia have gone as far as Ningaloo Reef in northwest WA, or to the Great Barrier Reef and beyond on the east coast as well. But what we're still trying to learn more about is why they're going to this location. We know where, but the why is still lesser known. And some of the reason for that is because if you think about it, like these sharks, some of the main reason would be for reproduction or maybe for feeding purposes. We think that they're moving to these places for feeding reasons. But at the same time, there's plenty of food down here in South Australia. So why do they need to go all the way to Ningaloo Reef whilst they could just save some energy and feed along amongst all the different fish and seals that we do have here? It might be related to a need for a diversity in diet. It might also be simply from a predator-prey perspective. If they stayed in the same spot for too long, the preys might be more clued up on the presence of the white sharks, making it harder for them. But that's the kind of thing we still don't know and we're still kind of working towards. The other thing which we're starting to realize with white sharks that is really interesting, at least from my biased perspective, is that whilst there are some patterns in their movements, so for example, the ones in South Australia tend to go west. Some of them do go east, and we do get some of the New South Wales sharks coming to South Australia as well. But there seems to be some patterns where the ones down here go west, and the one in New South Wales stays in New South Wales or go to New Zealand. But beyond these patterns, there's a huge amount of individual variation between sharks. So, for example, at the Neptune Islands, where we've done a lot of research, but some of the other offshore islands, we can get white sharks all year round, but it's not the same white sharks that you're going to get throughout the year. So you're going to have some summer sharks and some winter sharks, and even those summer sharks might end up moving at different rates, at different speeds, to different locations. Okay. So there's that individual variation beyond the best environmental conditions. Normally, you'd expect that shark would aggregate at one spot at one time because that's when the conditions are best. But we're seeing some sharks aggregating at a certain time at the Neptunes and other sharks aggregating at the same place at different times.
Okay. So are there two sort of populations? Like, is the ones on the east coast defined as one population and the southern west coast ones a different population?
So that's an interesting question, and we're currently doing some of that research. Like, the original genetic testing and analysis suggested two subpopulations.
Okay.
But there's been some recent work that just came out in the last 6 months that suggests it's actually one genetic population.
Okay.
And I guess that's the important to differentiate between genetic stock structure or population versus maybe demographic stock structure or populations, is that whilst they can still be one population in Australia, there could still be some separation between what different individuals do at a demographic level or at a shorter temporal scale level. And that's because you don't need many individuals to mix between area for those to become a one population at a genetic level.
Okay, that makes sense. So just so that I can get this straight, great white sharks, are they found like across the whole of the southern area of the world? Or is it?
Southern and northern as well.
And northern, okay.
Yes. So you can find them in northern hemisphere as much as the southern
hemisphere.
And
where do they kind of stop? Like just across the kind of more tropical waters?
Yes and no. No, they're all a good question. And I think the interesting thing is that we keep increasing our knowledge with regards to that. If you had asked me that question 10 years ago, I would have given you a different answer to now.
Okay.
So, for example, in South Australia, we now have had some individuals going as far south as some of these sub-Antarctic islands.
Wow. Okay.
So they're mostly remaining around the coast, but some individual, again, that individual variation, have gone actually quite close to Macquarie Island, for example.
All right.
From the northern perspective, there's actually been one white, or there are white sharks sighted of Indonesia every now and then. And one of those has been identified to have come from South Africa.
Whoa.
It wasn't a white shark from Australia. It was one from South Africa that ended up in Indonesia. You can also get white sharks in Hawaii as well. So they're not just limited to temperate regions. They're mostly found in temperate regions, but they can go in subtropical or tropical areas, and they can also go in sub-Antarctic areas.
Okay, so they are quite widespread. That makes me feel, I feel like whenever I go to the Northern Territory, I'm only worrying about crocodiles, but you could also have white sharks.
But yeah, low numbers, but it's not impossible.
Low chance. Okay.
So you also mentioned a bit about the individual variation, and what we see in at least some fish species is we've got resident and migratory fish within the same area. Do you see that in white sharks? Like, you've mentioned the summer and the winter ones, but...
Yeah. It's possible. We're certainly getting, like, for example, at the Neptune, some individuals will be seen once and never again. and other individuals would be there for 2 or 3 weeks every year at the same time of the year.
Okay.
So it's not so much resident versus migrant, but it could be that kind of partial migration when different individuals do different things. But I do think that it goes more at an individual level, because even within those that move and migrate, we get different trends, different patterns, different tracks, different directions.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. So you have mentioned some of the tagging, but you obviously use lots of high-tech methods like some satellite tagging and underwater drones and things like that. Mm. Can you give us a glimpse into how you actually study a white shark?
The technology that has become available to scientists has become, you know, very impressive, and it keeps growing all the time. And I think that we do need to be very careful in terms of using the right technology or the right tool for the right questions. And just with tagging, for example, there's a whole range of different tags that can be used. And I always get students coming up to me and say they want to come and tag sharks, which is great. But why you want to tag sharks? You know, what's your questions to that would deserve some, or that would justify some tagging? And just in the case of tagging, for example, we have used acoustic tags, which are great to record and monitor how long sharks spend at specific places. We've also used satellite tags, which are great if you want to look at the large-scale migrations or movements of these individuals. We've also used pop-up tags, which are good for sharks that don't come up to the surface, because some of these other tags requires the sharks to come to the surface to get some information. So we've used a lot of them depending on the questions, but we've now also moved towards getting a finer details about some of the behavior of the white sharks. So, for example, we started to use accelerometers, which measure the activity of the sharks, and that can be used as a proxy for energy expenditure. So that gives information about how much energy the sharks are spending, which we use, for example, in relation to wildlife tourism. Is wildlife tourism costing more energy to the sharks than some of the other types of behaviors? And we're also using it to try to understand the energy budget of these white sharks in relation to how much food or how much predation they might be doing. For the predation perspective, for the food intake, we're using these new types of tag that we're working with the manufacturers to develop, which are called the ingestion digestion tags, which are a bit of a mouthful, so we prefer to call it the feeding pill. Much easier. And the way those works is that they can monitor the connectivity changes inside the stomach of the sharks, so that it gives information of when sharks are ingesting food and how big that food is.
Whoa.
So we now understanding how often these sharks might be predating on things, and that gives us that aspect of energy gain through consumption versus the energy expenditure through these accelerometer tag. So that's kind of the new thing that we're doing, and it gives you an example of this whole variety of technology that can be used. And the more we develop this technology, the more details we'll get to unravel in terms of the secret lives of these sharks.
Wow. Tech is so important in science, isn't it? That's crazy.
And it's really amazing how it's developed from, like, you know, your T-bar and those sorts of tags through to the satellite tags and just the innovations that are happening. It's incredible.
Change in technology has been very impressive, but at the same time, we need to, as I said, be very careful that we're not just using the technology because it sounds cool.
Yeah, for the sake of it.
And exactly. Even these T-bars, these conventional tag IDs, can still provide some useful information too.
That's yeah, right. For sure. So moving on to this predator-prey interaction sort of stuff, and I just want to talk a bit about how shark bites can get a lot of media attention, and what does the science actually tell us about the risk and perception of this, and how is your research helping to inform shark management strategies?
So shark bites are one of these examples of what we call high consequence, low probability types of events. And these type of events are typically perceived as occurring more frequently than they actually are.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because of the high consequence of it. Other example of these type of events would be earthquake, nuclear disasters. But what we're seeing now is that, unfortunately, in a way, these events are actually becoming more and more frequent as well. So there's already the perception that they occur more frequently than they really are, and now it's increasing, so it's really becoming on everybody's mind as well.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of the issues with shark bites. We are seeing an increased number of shark bites in Australia and also internationally, but the risk is still very, very low.
Mm-hmm.
The other problem, though, is that I'm a bit concerned about some of the statistics being used oftentimes to compare shark bite risks with other risks, because I don't think they're real or that useful. Mm-hmm. I often use the example of one of these stats saying you're more likely to die from a coconut falling on your head than from a shark bite. Mm-hmm. Well, this might be true if you live in the tropics, but to a South Australian who's never gone to the tropics or never left South Australia, they're not very likely to be dying from a coconut. But to some people that spend a lot of time in the water, like up divers that spend hours every day in the water, or surfers on the West Coast that go surfing every single morning, the risk is still low, but the risk actually increases for these kind of people. And we do need to be mindful of that, those risks for these people, and to start thinking about how you can reduce risks. And that's where that policy aspect and science comes into play, where you can try to learn more about what the actual risk is, learn more about what the different shark bite mitigation measures can do or cannot do, so that you can help reducing the actual risks for these people.
Yeah, for sure.
You've touched a bit on policy, so we might just head there. Mm-hmm. You've obviously been involved in advising government policy and shark safety programs across Australia. How is the science actually helping to shape these policies, and what do you wish more people understood about the process?
I think we have seen, because of this increased number of shark bites, a huge increase in the number of these product device measures being developed or being commercially available to reduce shark bite risks. And a lot of them don't work, but some of them actually do work. And that's where science can be very helpful in informing government, but also the public, in terms of which one is worth maybe buying and considering, and which one you shouldn't be looking at. There's some good examples out there as well. For example, some of the work we've done on shark bite deterrence, as I said, shown that many of them don't work, but some of them do work and can reduce the risk of a shark bite by 60%. There is the misconception that it only works when the shark is inquisitive and not in a predatory mode. We have seen, we've got plenty of data and example of shark coming at speed, being in a predatory mode, attempting to breach on our testing rig, with the deterrent stopping that kind of behavior as well. So these deterrents can stop a predatory shark as well. Mm-hmm. And those results in that science was used, for example, by the WA government to form a rebate program so that people can get discounted or rebate price for these shark deterrents that were scientifically tested and published in peer-reviewed journals and publication. So that's an example where, I guess, science and the findings of these deterrents have used policies to inform governmental decisions. There's also some really good work that's happened in New South Wales, where they're increasingly moving towards non-lethal measures, and they've got a very comprehensive shark control program and shark management strategy. And that is based on a lot of the science, and you just have to start searching from some of the science and papers from New South Wales DPI, and you'll see that they've done a lot of work to support the decision in terms of which measure to implement.
That's awesome.
You did mention that deterring sharks 60% of the time. Mm-hmm. So with all of these devices, I'm assuming there's still some variability around whether they deter or not.
Yeah, and what we found is, again, it seemed to be more depending on the individual rather than a specific situation. So that goes back to that individual variation, where some sharks were deterred 100% of the time, and for some sharks, they kept pushing through that electric field and be more likely to take the bait.
Yeah. So you are you lead the Southern Shark Ecology Group at Flinders Uni, which of course does work beyond great whites. You already have talked about your love for wobbegons, and I know you do a lot of work across rays and other shark species too. Can you tell us about some of the other species or projects that you're working on at the moment? Maybe one or two of your favourite.
Yeah, and thanks for the question, because obviously working on this charismatic megafauna, it does get a lot of the attention. But the truth is, as I mentioned earlier, there are more than 500 different species of sharks, and most of these species would be arguably in more need of research than white sharks. Some of the work that we're doing currently is some of these more lesser-known benthic species, and some of them we have here. We have them here on the doorstep in South Australia. Southern eagle rays, Port Jackson sharks, fiddler rays, quite topical at the moment with the algal bloom that we're seeing in South Australia. We've seen a lot of these actually lesser-known shark species washing up along our shores. So some of your listeners in South Australian community probably would have been exposed to some of these species more so than ever before. Mm-hmm. And we are doing some work on that. We've collected a whole range of specimens during when the bloom was at its peak, and we'll try to better understand the toxin level and maybe some of the mechanisms that have led to these species being maybe more affected than others. We're also doing some work on Port Jackson sharks at key aggregation sites. And again, people might not realize, but there are some spots along South Australia where you can go and see Port Jackson sharks every day throughout the year. Mm-hmm. And that in a way is quite interesting because it's very different to other places where you can get Port Jackson sharks. In along the New South Wales coastline, they're very, very migratory. You only really see them close to the coast in wintertime. And here we see them mostly in summer, but throughout the year. Mm. So there's some interesting movement ecology in relation to Port Jackson sharks that we're doing. We're also doing some work in Port River, where we've tagged a whole range of these sharks and ray species. And I was surprised by the biomass and the number of sharks and ray and the number of species that we found as well. Obviously, Port River is fairly industrial. There's lots of industries there. It is used. There's a lot of human activities up there, but a number of southern eagle rays, fiddler rays, smooth rays, shovel nose rays, Port Jackson sharks that we found completely surprised me, but gave us the opportunity of looking into those a bit more to try to understand how they're using this system and whether the human activities up and down that system has any effect on the movement and the diet of these species.
Oh, that's cool. So Port Jackson's only really aggregate in SA, like, as in they are found in other states, I know, of course, but then they're only really seen in those kind of, you know how that, like at Port Nalunga, you can see them at certain times of the year where they're sort of aggregating like that.
Yeah, and that's when we started seeing them a bit more in Port Nalunga, that's when we started doing a bit more work on it. And we realized that it's not just certain time of the year, you can actually see them off Christie's Beach all year round.
Wow.
So the Port Nalunga aggregation was kind of a spillover from probably the Christie's Beach one. But you can really see these Port Jackson sharks in certain spots like Christie's Beach all year round, but we don't really know where else they are. They're often also seen down in the middle of the Gulf, and it's typically the smaller individuals there too. So we're only scratching the surface in terms of what these Port Jackson sharks are doing here. Yeah. We know much more about them on the East Coast, not so much on the West Coast, and we're starting to understand more on the South Coast.
Cool. And our listeners are probably that go beach combing would see the eggs washed up, because they're those kind of cork shell or cork spiral type eggs, aren't they?
Yeah, and after big storms, you often can find these eggs on the beach. And if you're a diver, there's a few dive sites where you can find them up in the cracks and crevices of the reefs as well. Of Second Valley, there's a spot there where you can see them. Of Christie's Beach, of Horseshoe Reef, there's a spot where you can get hundreds of these eggs in the cracks and crevices.
That's really cool. For those people that don't know, Port Jacksons are not... They're smaller sharks, they're little, and they're very cute.
They are. So you've touched on people diving on sharks and things. Now, one of the areas that shark tourism's a big thing is over in Port Lincoln. What are the ecological and ethical considerations that scientists and managers need to think about in relation to the port, in relation to Port Lincoln shark diving, etc.?
So from an ethical perspective, I think that we need to consider any potential human impact, and there needs to be a justification for potentially affecting the species that we're interacting with. In terms of wildlife tourism, and in case of shark tourism, there is more than just providing the opportunity for people to going to see these animals in their wild environment. There actually is some social and economic benefits of shark tourism. There's plenty of research that highlights the education and benefits, the change of attitude, and the increase in conservation behavior. And there's the old saying of, you know, you love what you know and you protect what you love. And that's where wildlife tourism can play a role. And I think that's where, from an ethical perspective, it can be justified because of the social benefits that it provides. From an economic benefits, that industry, for example, is providing $15 million annually, and not just to the industry itself, but to the region as well. And that's because we've done some surveys that show that 80% of the people going there would not have come to Port Lincoln if it wasn't for the cage diving industry. So it does bring a lot of people to the region, and they stay longer to do other activities. There's also about 10% of international tourists that plan the entire Australian holiday because they wanted to come cage diving. Mm-hmm. And that's in the same way as an Australian, and I've done it, planning a whole trip to Africa to go and see the gorillas. Yeah. So there is...
I've done that too.
There you go. And it does bring international tourism to Australia as well. So that's from an economic perspective, it's also quite large as well. Now, from an ecological perspective, we also need to make sure that we're minimizing any impact on the species that you're interacting with, but also the ecosystem that supports them. And there's been a lot of research that has been done for many years now. And I think that the cage diving industry is a good example of something that was done well, in the way that there was an issue. The intensity of the industry increased back in the late 2000s, and that led to an increased residency of the sharks in that area. As a result of that, there was many discussions and the implementation of a new policy and new regulation, but also a monitoring program that was checking that the new regulation was working or not, mm-hmm. kind of an adaptable type of regulation and policy. And thanks to this regulation, the residency of the shark went back down to the baseline level. So it's an example of identifying an issue, putting regulation and policy in place to manage that issue, and ensuring that we can show that this regulation worked or not. And it's been really positive in that way. There's still a lot of regulation in place. And I think that's really important, because if you don't have that, it's when wildlife tourism can become really bad for these species. And just recently, I saw a perfect bad example of that when I was in Zanzibar and just went on a snorkeling trip. It wasn't a work trip, it was just a holiday. And on the way there, you could go in and snorkel with dolphins. And it was absolute chaos. I felt so bad for dolphins. And don't get me wrong, I'm biased against dolphins because I prefer sharks. But it was still so, there was like 20, 30, 40 boats just like within meters of these poor dolphins that only came up to breathe once because they were being literally harassed by all of these boats.
Yeah.
So that's the example of how bad it can be. And in comparison, you see that in Australia, mostly in here in South Australia, that wildlife tourism is pretty well managed.
We have good legislation on that stuff, yeah. Don't we?
There's also the concern that a lot of community members have in relation to the potential conditioning or learning that wild shark has in relation to boats or humans, and the potential impact in terms of human safety. And I totally understand these concerns, because we need to make sure that it doesn't occur. And there are plenty of places where sharks do learn and where sharks can associate food or reward with boat or with location. But we've actually specifically tested that at the Neptune Island. We use 4 years of data, of that tracking data, as well as on more than 70 different sharks. And we didn't find any conditioning taking place. And if anything, we actually found the opposite. We detected some evidence of habituation, where sharks lost interest in the boat the longer they were at the Neptune Islands. And the reason why we think it happens is that, sure, they use burley, but sharks don't feed on the burley. And they do use bait, but the bait is removed before the shark can take it. And they can take the bait sometimes, but they don't get the bait enough to have sufficient rewards to make that association between food and the boat or the location. And they're actually losing interest in the burley because they don't get the reward that they're expecting. So yeah. The longer they're exposed to the burley without the reward, the least likely they are to respond to that burley.
Yeah,
fascinating.
That makes sense. Have you been shark cage diving?
No, I haven't.
It's on my bucket list item. I'm not yet to do it either. You've probably done it many times.
A few times indeed, but you should do it. It's definitely worth it. And I think that the people that are worried about how the cage diving might be influencing sharks should go and do it, because it'd be an eye-opener in terms of the reality of it.
Speaking of incredible field trips and all these expeditions that you've been able to do over your time as a shark scientist, do you have one favourite shark encounter or moment in the field that is like your favourite?
It's really hard to pick one of these moments, because there's so many, and every trip is amazing in their own ways. But one example of a particular situation I remember is, I call it the whale shark sandwich. when I was doing some work again on wildlife tourism in the Philippines, in Oslop, where again it is a bit chaotic because there's a lot of people that go there to swim and snorkel with whale sharks. This is also where the whale sharks are being fed to keep them in a certain area. And you can see sometimes up to 20 whale shark in an area smaller than half a size of football field. So there's a lot of whale sharks there. And we were doing some work using accelerometers to measure the energy expenditure during this wildlife tourism activity. We had the accelerometer on the dorsal fin of the sharks, but we didn't want tourist boats or other sharks to kind of kick it off so that we'd lose the accelerometer. So whenever we had an accelerometer deployed, we had one snorkeler staying with that shark to make sure that it would stay in location. And I remember at one point, another shark becoming a bit too close to the shark that had the accelerometer. And I ended up having to try to push it away. So I was between these two whale sharks trying to push them away from each other. And then I realized I was actually doing nothing, but the sharks kept coming closer and closer to me, and I was nearly getting squished by two whale sharks.
That is so cool.
That is so cool. So one of the things that's affecting many marine species is climate change and ocean warming. Are we seeing changes in shark distribution or behaviour as a result?
Yeah, there's been an increasing number of studies that are starting to look at the effect of climate change with a range of animals, including sharks. The main one we're seeing is obviously this tropicalization, where these warm water species become more and more likely to be sighted and found in temperate or colder temperature. But we're also seeing more than that, and there's more and more work looking at the effect of deoxygenation of the water on the sharks. And that can occur from climate change, just from increased temperature that leads to algal bloom, for example. And it's very topical here at the moment. It can also happen from as a result of ocean acidification too. That's changing the oxygen in the water. And just the increase of temperature changes the solubility of oxygen in the water as well. So this means that they might be part of the ocean where that oxygen level is changing. And there's been a very interesting study that's looking at the depth of the deep scattering layer, which is this layer of high productivity in terms of zooplankton and phytoplankton, that might be becoming higher up, which means that it's changing the vertical distribution of sharks. And there's been some studies on blue sharks, for example, that's showing that these blue sharks might be becoming shallower and shallower following that deep scattering layer. And that's basically affecting their foraging strategies, their predator-prey interaction, but can also lead to increased overlap with fisheries. Because as that scattering layer is becoming shallower and the sharks spend more time shallow as well, they're becoming more likely to encounter some fishing gear that they were originally avoiding by being deeper, but then now the overlap has increased, increasing their vulnerability. Wow. So this is an example of climate change affecting, I guess, the water, which affects the sharks, which affect their vulnerability to fishing pressure.
It's also connected, isn't it? So last question now. So for any young people or students who are fascinated by sharks, as you were as a 12-year-old, what advice would you give to them if they're dreaming of a career in marine science?
I would say do it, work hard at it, and don't give up. And I think don't let people tell you that there is no job in that industry. It's certainly hard and you have to work hard to get jobs and to be successful. But every single one of my students have got really good jobs now that they really enjoy. And I know as well that all of Bronwyn's students have really good jobs as well. So I think there's this preconceived idea that you can't get a job in marine science. And this might be true 20 years ago and there may be less opportunities. But I do feel like now for those that work hard and do the right thing, there are jobs out there.
Yeah, for sure. I find that very inspiring. So that brings us to the end of the episode. Thank you so much, Charlie. That was really awesome. I learn a lot. I feel like I love sharks, but you love them to a next level.
Yeah, some people would call it an addiction.
But you're still question focused, which is what I like. So you've come up with the question and then use the suitable shark species to address it. That's what I think is important.
Yeah, and that's why, in a way, I always get the question of, you know, why do you like white sharks so much? Like, I don't. I like the question that I get to answer about white sharks.
Yeah, definitely. So thank you so much, Charlie. That was really amazing.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
So if you've got questions, cool ocean facts or stories to share, hit us up on social media or through email. You can find the contacts in the show notes. We'd love to hear from you. And if you enjoyed this episode, make sure to follow Ocean Pod wherever you are listening to your podcast and leave us a review. It really helps ocean lovers find us.
Music written and performed by Seamus Nicholas. Graphic design by Rhiannon Van Eck. This podcast is produced by us, Nina and Bronwyn, supported by the School of Biological Sciences at the University of Adelaide.